This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jackson Bunganyi, and here is what is coming up.
It is said also in the southern part of Nigeria that when somebody dies, all sins are forgiven. So southern part of Nigeria has really forgiven the Queen. I feel pained.
That is Dr. Ekoma Ogwo, a medical practitioner from one of the southern states in Nigeria. All of this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. And for our top story, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, is releasing $100 million from its Central Emergency Response Fund to assist millions of people in what it calls 11 forgotten emergencies. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
OCHA reports money for 11 humanitarian operations in Africa, Asia, the Americas, and the Middle East has dried up, putting the lives and livelihoods of millions of people at risk. The United Nations says it needs $49.5 billion this year to assist 204 million people threatened by conflict, climate shocks, hunger, and forced displacement. To date, only $17.6 billion of this total amount has been received. While this is a large amount of money, OCHA deputy spokesman Jens Laerke says the funding gap is nearly $32 billion, the largest it has ever been. He says the release of $100 million is meant to shrink this critical funding gap and address the problem head on.
It may seem like a drop in the bucket. And if you look at it from that perspective, it is a drop in the bucket. But the SURF funds, a key criteria is that it has to go to life-saving projects. So it is the worst of the worst that we are trying to address with the SURF funding. And I guarantee you, for those whose lives is hanging by a thread, it means something.
Laerke says the consequences for hundreds of millions of vulnerable people will be many and very severe if money to assist them at this time of greatest need is not forthcoming.
That can range from loss of life, to victims of or survivors of gender-based violence who receive no support, children who do not get the vaccines that they need, and so on and so forth.
Laerke says the $100 million will help scale up life-saving operations in the 11 countries, which include Yemen, South Sudan, Myanmar, and Venezuela. He notes SURF has allocated a record $250 million so far this year to countries that are in a desperate state but largely overlooked. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in the Democratic Republic of the Congo declared a resurgence of Ebola after one case was recently confirmed by local health authorities in the eastern city of Beni. Health experts say the case was genetically linked to the 2018-2020 Ebola outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. That is the country's deadliest on record. The country has recorded 14 outbreaks since 1976. The WHO said the Ebola resurgences were concerning and called for a stronger disease surveillance in the region. Dr. William Klemmer is the Senior Technical Advisor, Health, Nutrition and Humanitarian Programs for the organization Chorus World Health. He joins me from the city of Goma in the eastern DRC to talk about the increased incidence of infectious diseases in the area and how the global COVID-19 pandemic has affected local healthcare strategies. I asked him if he's worried that this latest resurgence could spread to other areas.
Thank you, Jackson. Excellent question. It is a growing concern, not just here in Congo, but certainly, you know, across Africa. And, you know, Jackson, if you look at Ebola outbreaks, they are becoming more frequent, larger, and consequently deadlier. You know, Ebola was first detected here in Zaire in 1976. And for the next 38 years, outbreaks were largely in, you know, remote areas close to tropical rainforest, which, you know, basically affected less than 200 to 300 people. Here in the Congo, they have documented 15 outbreaks since Ebola was first discovered in 1976, 46 years ago. But half of those outbreaks, Jackson, have occurred in the last 6 to 8 years. And like the West Africa outbreak, are starting to reach urban settings.
My question to you, I guess, is why has it been hard to completely eradicate Ebola in the DRC like we saw in these three West African countries in 2016?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that it's been totally eradicated, even from West Africa. What we are seeing now in the Congo, as I mentioned, Congo's largest and deadliest outbreak was from 2018 to 2020, over 3,000 cases. Much different than the previous outbreaks where you had, you know, 30 to 40, sometimes 200 to 300 cases, but they lasted for several months. What we have seen most recently, both in eastern Congo as well as in northwestern Congo, a corner closer to the capital city of Kinshasa, is these are strains that are basically genetically linked to the original outbreak. So in a way, the outbreak never really stopped. So I think that we need to recognize that it is a disease that is with us and that will be with us. And our challenge is to better manage it and to be vigilant, to know that it is in our midst. And if we deny it and if we say it's gone, then...
Let me ask you about other infectious diseases. How has... we've been... In this global pandemic, the COVID-19 global pandemic, for over 2 years now, how has the pandemic complicated local or national strategies to fight Ebola and other infectious diseases like malaria?
Excellent question. I mean, there is no doubt that all these outbreaks have better prepared countries like the Congo to better deal with it. Africa has like the highest infectious disease burden and the most underfunded public health system, but they seem to manage okay, given the burden of disease. At the start of the COVID outbreak, I was here in Eastern Congo. We had a team of international health advisors come to this city and caution that this region was not at all prepared to handle COVID. Some even said we could see bodies lying in the street. Direct quote from international experts who came to Eastern Congo. And contrary to popular beliefs, African countries had comparatively fewer COVID cases than other country cases. And, you know, I was here during most of the duration of the COVID outbreak here in Eastern Congo, and, you know, we did quite well. It's a population that has lived with, you know, endemic diseases, compliant with management. And there's a system in place for early recognition, early response, and now treatment.
That was Dr. William Clemmer. He's with the organization Chorus World Health. Nigerians from different walks of life are continuing to pay tribute to the late British monarch Queen Elizabeth II, who recently died at the age of 96. Nigeria has deep roots, with Britain having gained her independence in 1960. But some, however, view the Queen's role and influence differently. Here's more from Abuja in Nigeria.
A medical practitioner from one of the southern states in Nigeria, Dr. Ekoma Ogwo, is particular about the role of Britain during the country's 30-month civil war in the late 1960s under her reign.
We feel pained that we've lost Queen Elizabeth. But as somebody from southern part of Nigeria, there may be some misgivings about the roles played by the Queen during the Nigerian Biafran Civil War. But it is said also in the southern part of Nigeria that when somebody dies, all sins are forgiven. So the southern part of Nigeria has really forgiven the Queen, and we feel pained. This is what we call death of celebration, when somebody has reigned for 70 years.
A public servant, Eki Uzo, is also critical about the Queen's reign, saying she made no positive impact on the country.
No doubt it's a sad moment for Nigeria and the whole world, but I think that Nigeria could have benefited more from her. Being her African colony, we could have had more positive impact on international policies. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. So for me, it's a huge loss, and I don't think I really felt her impact as a Nigerian. while she was alive.
On the contrary, a public affairs commentator, Victorson Abwinson, describes the Queen as a quintessential leader who championed the cause of peace, justice and fairness amongst the Commonwealth nations.
Yes, the death of the Queen, to those of us who are not bitter, unlike those of our brothers from the southeast who feel that Nigeria is a mistake fomented and enabled by the colonialists, the British, to those of us who feel a sense of personal loss in a way, because Queen Elizabeth was our first head of state, as it were. So beyond colonialism, she has become a very amiable mother figure, mother monarch, loved by a lot of children across the world, a lot of women across the world, and a symbol, an icon of possibility to womanhood. So we'll really miss her.
Queen Elizabeth was an iconic monarch whose era witnessed the end of colonization and the coming of independence, though there's perhaps a never-ending debate over whether the UK has always used its influence to promote economic growth, democracy, and good governance to Nigeria. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa is meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House, aiming to pick up where they left off during an hour-long chat in April. He also met with Vice President Kamala Harris. South African government sources have told VOA that talks will be about the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, that's AGOA, will top the agenda along with trade and other issues. I spoke with VOA's Heidi Fitzpatrick, who is at the White House.
You will remember this meeting comes on the back of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to South Africa last month, where he launched the U.S. strategy towards southern sub-Saharan Africa. So the White House is putting emphasis on South Africa's strategic importance here, both politically and economically, saying South Africa is a leader on the African continent, a prominent voice in the global south, and of course South Africa being the only African member of the G20 and the BRICS grouping. A senior White House official tells the media that the world is facing growing divisions and that the U.S. wants to hear South Africa's perspective, saying that the U.S. and indeed the world can't make progress on these challenges and issues without South African leadership and contributions. And just briefly, this morning, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris hosted a breakfast for President Ramaphosa at the Vice President's residence. There they said that they were going to discuss health care, women's empowerment, and other shared issues, of course. And in a short while, the two heads of state, Presidents Biden and Ramaphosa, will meet here at the White House in the Oval Office.
Right. And sources have told VOA that top of the agenda would be AGOA, that is the African Growth and Opportunity Act. What else are the two leaders expected to discuss during their meeting?
Well, you're correct, Jackson. Money is going to be a very important part, and investment is going to be a very important part of the discussion. The two leaders are expected to discuss trade, investment, infrastructure, climate and energy, and health. Now, the White House has confirmed the war in Ukraine will most certainly be on the agenda, and they want to hear President Ramaphosa's perspective. Now, based on what the South Africans have indicated, President Ramaphosa will emphasize a need for dialogue on this issue, for a multilateral approach to resolve the crisis in Ukraine. But here's where we might see a sticking point. There is a bill moving through the U.S. Congress at the moment. It's called the Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act. And this bill, which has bipartisan support in the U.S. House of Representatives, where it has passed, if this bill is passed in the Senate and signed into law by President Biden, it would essentially sanction countries that trade with Russia. And this could speak to the timing of this meeting. The U.S. is South Africa's third largest trading partner after China and the EU. And there are about 600 U.S. companies operating in South Africa. So there are serious trade matters at stake here. And some African countries will no doubt see a law passed in the U.S. like this as punishment for not voting with the U.S. on Ukraine Ukraine at the United Nations. But both South Africa and the U.S. wants to preserve and even deepen and expand the business relationship here.
Now, President Joe Biden last spoke with President Ramaphosa back in April. They had a long hour chat. What is the state of the relationship between South Africa and the U.S.? Are there any other areas of disagreement that are likely to cause some tension during the meeting?
Well, look, this is going to be a complete diplomatic balancing act for the two leaders. And the White House has indicated that the tone of today's meeting will reflect the tone of previous discussions they've had. As you mentioned earlier, they spoke earlier in the year, and as the White House that those discussions were warm and productive. They expect that it's going to be the same. They're downplaying any real tension here. But it's important to remember that there could be more forward-looking discussions taking place here because President Cyril Ramaphosa is seen on the global stage as a skilled negotiator. And while there may be criticism of that those skills have failed him at home in South Africa's domestic politics, he has played a big role in the constitutional negotiations that ended apartheid in the early 1990s. He's played a big role in the Northern Island peace process in the late 1990s. So Ramaphosa is seen on the global stage as highly persuasive, highly personable, and that his negotiating style is about consultation, about compromise, about consensus through dialogue, especially when it comes to getting two sides to lay down their weapons. So we might see something different at play here that could see Cyril Ramaphosa playing a very important and integral role in helping resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
That is VOA's Heidi Fitzpatrick at the White House. The U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, hosted talks yesterday at the Pentagon with Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud. Among the issues discussed was the threat posed by the Somali-based terrorist group Al-Shabaab. In remarks, Secretary Austin affirmed the partnership between the two nations in the fight against extremists in Somalia and the Horn of Africa.
I was encouraged to hear of the Somali-led operations in August against Al-Shabaab after its July incursion into Ethiopian territory. Our cooperation here is crucial, Mr. President, and we stand ready as your partners to help you defend yourselves against these violent forces.
President Hassan thanked the United States government for its strategic partnership with the Somali people and their fight against Al-Shabaab.
Secretary, thank you very much again. It's a great pleasure and honor for me to be here again. I want to extend my gratitude to the United States government for its strategic partnership with the Somali people in our fight against Al-Shabaab, as well as the provision of critical humanitarian development support as well.
For more on President Hassan Mahmoud's visit to the U.S., I'm joined by VOA Somali senior editor Haroon Maruf. Hello, Haroon.
Hi, Jackson. Thanks for having me.
What else is on President Mahmoud's agenda during his visit to the U.S.?
Security seems to be the main aspect of the partnership between Somalia and United States. Somalia hosts a small number of U.S. forces who are training elite Somali forces. United States have also been conducting airstrikes against Al-Shabaab, which have been a big part of the pushback against Al-Shabaab attacks and the movement of their fighters within the country. So President Hassan came here to reaffirm that relationship. He told during a talk today at CSIS that the United States has proven to be the most reliable partner for Somalia, and he applauded that relationship, and he also said he looks forward to improving that partnership. He also wanted support for his new strategy towards Al-Shabaab. He mentioned that in the past, the strategy against Al-Shabaab focused on two areas, containing Al-Shabaab within the boundaries of Somalia, and degrading the group. And he said the way these two strategies were approached did not materialize. And he wants to add two more dimensions. He wants an ideological approach against Al-Shabaab. He wants an economical approach against Al-Shabaab. And he also said categorically that he wants Somali forces within partnership with the international community, including the United States, to remove Al-Shabaab geographically from a large number of Somalia's countryside. Mm-hmm. And he said Al-Shabaab is not ready for talks at the moment, and he wants to take them to a place where he can force them, some of them at least, to open dialogue with the government.
Okay.
And that's what he was reinforcing.
And I understand that President Mahmoud addressed the issue of Somali soldiers in Eritrea. What did he say?
He said a big part of the Somali forces who will be playing important role in fighting against Al-Shabaab will be about 5,000 Somali troops who were trained in Eritrea. These troops were taken to Eritrea initially in 2019-2020, but that operation was clouded by secrecy. And at the time, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud was an opposition leader, and he criticized the secrecy surrounding that operation, and he wanted the troops brought back home. What he disclosed today was that because after they concluded the training of Somali forces in Eritrea, the Eritrean government was hesitant to return them immediately to Somalia. And he said that was because of the political turmoil in Somalia, the differences, the electoral process, which divided the different groups. And he said Eritrea decided to hold them and make sure Somalia sort out their differences, and then they will ask them to return their soldiers to Somalia. And he said his government is working at this time with the help of the United States in returning these troops. And he said they will be a big part of the fighting against Al-Shabaab.
All right. That's VOA Somali senior editor Haroon Maroof. Thank you, Haroon.
Most welcome. Thank you.
Mali's military government has called Ivory Coast's request for a regional meeting on Ivorian troops detained in Mali since July, quote, intimidation and blackmail. Ivory Coast accuses Mali of holding its troops hostage, as Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako in Mali.
The Malian government's official statement says that it is in no way concerned by Ivory Coast's request to hold a meeting with regional bloc ECOWAS over the detained troops. The statement was read on state television station ORTM by government spokesperson and interim prime minister, Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga, and posted to the station's Facebook page.
Le gouvernement de la transition, tout en réitérant son attachement,
he says, the transitional government, while reiterating its attachment to peace, security, and age-old good neighborly relations, specifies that for the respect of its sovereignty, its national security, and the interests of its people, it will yield to neither blackmail nor intimidation. Ivory Coast's National Security Council published a statement Wednesday requesting an ECOWAS meeting and accusing Mali of taking the soldiers hostage. The 49 soldiers from Ivory Coast arrived at the Bamako airport in July as support for a UN contingent. Mali arrested the soldiers, accusing them of being mercenaries. Olivier Salgado, former spokesperson for the UN mission to Mali, MINUSMA, was expelled from the country after he tweeted that the UN had notified Mali of the soldiers' arrival. Mali's military government maintained in Thursday's statement that the troops arrived in Mali in possession of weapons and munitions of war, without a mission order or authorization, while concealing their identities and their real professions, as well as the precise purpose of their presence on Malian soil. Three female soldiers were freed earlier this month, leaving 46 troops still in custody. Malian interim president Assimi Goïta said last week that Malian political figures fleeing prosecution by the military government have been given asylum in Ivory Coast, and that he was seeking a mutually beneficial solution to the diplomatic crisis. Tensions between Mali and ECOWAS have been high this year, with ECOWAS imposing sanctions on Mali in January over an election delay. Sanctions were lifted in July when Mali set an election date for 2024. France backed the sanctions and in August withdrew all of its troops after almost a decade over concerns that Mali is working with Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Every year, world leaders gather in New York for the annual United Nations General Assembly. Count on VOA to be there. delivering news you can trust on radio, TV, and the web. A free press is essential. VOA Africa, your trusted source.